This is class number two in the Analysis of Literature second semester course. And today we continue discussing the literature in chapter six, specifically the novel by Mark Twain entitled The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Just as a reminder, your written assignment in chapter six is due by class number three, and it is as follows. Question number two in the assignment, you need to write a 1 to 2 page paper answering this question. Question number 13, write a 1 page paper answering this question. Question number 24, write a list answering this question. Also, you need to, before class number three, make sure to have read chapter seven in your student textbook, because in that class we discuss chapter seven. All right, we're going to continue on looking at some of the questions in the assignment that you're not going to have to write anything on, but the assignment for chapter six. And I believe we left off, we had discussed as far as a synopsis of the plot of the novel. Now, I'd like to ask you this, question number 10. It says, Mark Twain concluded his life as a sad pessimist. Are there any indications in his work, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, from which one may have predicted this outcome of the author?
Huckleberry Finn was cynical about religion and humanity.
Okay. Yes, he was Huckleberry Finn. The character Huckleberry Finn was cynical about religion and I guess many things. So that cynicism comes through. Now, in terms of the cynicism, though, you know, what is the difference between cynicism and holding to the doctrine of the depravity of man or the total depravity of man? How would those two differ?
Maybe cynicism says that you can't do anything about it.
Right. Okay. One difference is that it just sort of accepts the depravity of man as a given without any hope of redemption from that.
Total depravity makes you look at man realistically. You know, his sad state in sin, but you know that there is a God who is not like man.
Right. That is the another element in this, right? Is that there is the belief in Jesus Christ that there was at least one man in human history, at least one man, that was perfectly righteous. And so, as much as we must have a certain degree of realistic negativity about the nature of fallen humanity, a cynic fails to consider the example of Jesus Christ. And so, a certain portion of reality they are purposefully blind to. Any other difference or any other things in terms of then Mark Twain that would lead you perhaps to have expected that he would have ended his life as really a very sad man, besides being cynical, he just was very sad and pessimistic. Any other things that might have led you to? Predict this outcome? Yeah, I guess, you know, again, there was no one in his book that was necessarily different. One saw the different aspects of these characters, but none of them gave one hope that there would be, I think, as we've said, redemption. All right. Now, question 11. Consider this review of Huckleberry Finn. And it goes, quote, "Mark Twain is a humorist or nothing. He is well aware of the fact himself, for he prefaces the adventures of Huckleberry Finn with a brief notice warning persons in search of a moral motive or plot that they are liable to be prosecuted, banished, or shot. This is a nice little artifice to scare off the critics. A kind of trespassers on these grounds will be dealt with according to law. However, as there is no penalty attached, we organized a search expedition for the humorous qualities of this book with the following hilarious results. 1, a very refined and delicate piece of narration by Huck Finn describing his venerable and dilapidated pap as afflicted with delirium tremens, rolling over and over, kicking things every which way, and saying there are devils of hold of him. This chapter is especially suited to amuse the children on long rainy afternoons. 2, an elevating and laughable description of how Huck killed a pig, smeared its blood on an axe, and mixed in a little of his own hair, and then ran off, setting up a job on the old man in the community, and leading them to believe him murdered. This little joke can be repeated by any smart boy for the amusement of his fond parents. 3, a graphic and romantic tale of a southern family feud which resulted in an elopement and from 6 to 8 choice corpses. Next, a polite version of the Gyasticus story in which a nude man striped with the colors of the rainbow is exhibited as the king's camelopard or the royal nunsuch. This is a chapter for Lenten parlor entertainments and church festivals. Next, a side-splitting account of a funeral enlivened by a sick melodeon, a long-legged undertaker, and a rat episode in the cellar. And thus ends that review. What do you make of that review? Do you agree with it or disagree with it? And what do you make of that review?
It sounded a bit sarcastic.
Yes. There is... irony in it. Now, what is the word irony?
When you don't actually mean what you literally say, but you're just doing it to make a point, which is the exact opposite of what you're saying.
Right. What point do you think this reviewer is trying to make then?
That he has a sick sense of humor.
That who does?
Mark Twain.
Right, right. This is a rather biting review, right? Or do you disagree with that of the book? Yeah, this is... we're going to read another... You're going to read another review in terms of question 13, because obviously many reviewers have more positive reviews of the book. But this particular review... is especially biting, and what particularly does he go after, this particular reviewer?
The humor of Mark Twain in the story.
Right, right. And that he does not think it is so funny. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that Mark Twain expected us to laugh at a number of these things? Do you think the reviewer thinks that Mark Twain expected us to laugh? Yes, okay. The reviewer felt that Mark Twain wanted us to laugh at these things. Do you think Mark Twain wanted us to laugh at these things?
At least some of those things.
Right. Like, which ones are you more sure he wanted us to laugh at?
I think the first one.
You mean about the... how he left his father?
Yeah,
okay. Well, no, I'm sorry, not his... I'm sorry, not how he left his father. How his father had delirium tremens and saying the devils are a hold of him. So the sort of the situation with the father. What about even in terms of, do you think there was a part of Mark Twain that admired the manner in which Huckleberry Finn escaped from his father?
Yes.
Yes. But to be fair with Mark Twain on this part, I mean, in one sense, the father was very cruel to his son. And so one could at least, I think, sympathize with, I mean, certainly the son trying to get away. I mean, it was to save his life in some sense. So I must admit on that second one, I don't know. I mean, what about the one about the Southern family feud? What did Mark Twain definitely want us to get across, want to get across on that one?
That they are hypocritical.
Right. And, you know, there is a certain sense in which, I mean, there are certainly many religious hypocrites. I mean, there's that is unquestionably the case. But I wonder, do you think that Mark Twain, in some sense, wanted us to laugh at that? You know, and I think that's the point of this reviewer. Do you think, in some sense... was Mark Twain's point there, look at how these Christians are hypocrites? Is that perhaps what he... I think there is good reason to believe that he wanted us, in one sense, to laugh at a mocking way at Christian hypocrisy. And is it appropriate to laugh? There are... I mean, should we laugh at Christian hypocrites? Like, I mean, who is the ultimate Christian hypocrite in Scripture?
Judas Iscariot.
Right. Are we meant to laugh at that? At hypocrites? No. Or what about the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Are we meant to laugh? Because aren't those, they portray, especially the Pharisees in Scripture, aren't they portrayed as hypocrites? Are we, in Scripture do we find, now, you know, again, that's something to consider. So anyway, that's how this reviewer... and again, you will be, there's a on question 13, there is the question, a newspaper article characterizing this particular novel, and you will be writing about that. All right, question 14. How does the Adventures of Huckleberry Finn qualify as a novel according to its characteristics? And again, we have to think back to what we read in terms of the introduction, defining the different genres. How does this qualify as a novel?
It's fiction and it's long.
Right. It's fiction, it's long. There are some other things that it is, too.
It has an extended plot with many characters.
Okay, it has a plot. There are just one or two other characteristics of a novel that you haven't yet mentioned. Because what you have said could still, in some sense, be a poem.
It's prose.
Prose. It's a prose narrative. Okay, so... those are the things that make it a novel. to fall under the category of novel instead of under the category, well, some other genre. Okay. Question 15. Why is it generally easier to convey a wicked message using fiction rather than nonfiction? Now, I'm not asking this question to say that all fiction is therefore wrong, but on the other hand, we just need to be realistic about the characteristics of the different genres. And why is it generally easier to convey a wicked message using fiction rather than nonfiction?
It's more subtle rather than direct.
Right, it can be more subtle.
And you can sometimes like disguise your message inside a story. And so you're not exactly saying it. He never explicitly said his point, but readers sort of infer from it that, you know, like Christians are hypocrites.
Okay. What about the fact that, are you bound to dealing with actuality? Are you bound to deal with what actually has happened in the world when you're talking about fiction? And how does the fact that you're not bound to it, how can that then be used to mold what you're trying to get across to your readers so that they will come to think in a different way?
He doesn't have to use real examples, so he can create an example.
Right, he can mold what his characters to do and say whatever he wants. So in one sense, he can create a world of his own. And even though it's in many ways divorced from reality, he can always, if someone says, well, but this is not what really happens, he can always fall back and say, well, this is a novel. This is not this is a work of fiction. I'm not saying that this actually happened. So you can portray things in an exaggerated way. For instance, I'm thinking too of, for instance, around the same time that this novel, a little bit earlier, Uncle Tom's Cabin was written. Do you know what Uncle Tom's Cabin? What was Uncle Tom's Cabin?
It was against slavery.
And what was, do you know sort of what was the overall, was it the overall plot? I mean, what was
that? Slavery was unjust and cruel.
Yeah, well, that was its thesis, okay, or theme. But what was the actual plot, sort of?
I don't know. It was like about like how Uncle Tom stood up against a cruel slaveholder and was, I think, beaten to death.
Yeah. The basic thing is you had this very subservient Uncle Tom, who was portrayed as, you know, very, you can portray him as very innocent and so forth, and then you have this very cruel slave taskmaster and so forth. And so, you can more easily make caricatures, and I'm not saying that there were none of that necessarily in the South, but that's a lot easier to do than taking real people. Okay, real people, and considering the complexity of the situation, so it's just easier.
Just think about the feature they had on NewsHour last night. If fiction does not affect the attitudes of people, why would the military spend millions of dollars having this organization in Hollywood screening the scripts of different Hollywood films portraying the military in different situations and then allowing them to use Army and Navy equipment as long as they depict the uniformed men and the whole organization of the military in a positive light?
Right. People are definitely influenced by what they read, and by what, if they do watch movies or drama, they are unquestionably influenced by them. Their worldview, whether they realize it or not, in some sense is being shaped. Now, to the extent that they're more discerning, they may or may not, but it is in some subtle sense being shaped. And one can, again, I'm not wanting to make the point here that this makes fiction wrong. We find in Scripture various parables. They're not meant to be, that these are actual events, but we just need to keep in mind fiction, because they're not even necessarily bound to try to do things according to what actually happened. It is much easier to make a caricature, and a caricature that is false, not true to reality. And again, they can always come back and say, well, the genre allows me to do it.
Wouldn't have, like, what is it, Stowe in her Uncle Tom's Cabin, wouldn't she have said that it was sort of reflecting reality then?
Oh, absolutely. I think Mark Twain would have some sense said that this novel reflects reality. What my response would be is if they were forced to do a real my response to, and again, I agree with some, perhaps some aspects of what Harriet Beecher Stowe even said there. But I think if she were to have to take a real person, Uncle Tom would not be nearly so innocent looking on the black side. And the slave master would not look quite so bad, perhaps, as she wanted him to be on the other side. There might be certain realities here. What, you know, as far as, it's just when you start having to deal with actual people, you can't caricature someone necessarily as easily as being totally bad and totally good, right? You start getting into the
people react to realities, and what makes that slaveholder probably looks meaner than what he really probably was, even if he existed in real life, was that he was doing these mean things to a very innocent and lovable Uncle Tom.
Right. I'm just saying you can more easily make caricatures. It's just easier. Instead of dealing with the complexities of the situation. Okay. One other point I'd make here as far as how fiction typically, what in terms of entertainment, again, fiction doesn't, in terms of Christ's parables that are fiction, how does entertainment enter into this picture? How can entertainment, the use of a genre for entertainment, perhaps as a primary purpose, right? I mean, why do people go to watch movies, for instance? Or why do people read these romantic love novels?
To be entertained.
To be entertained. That is at the very least, that is 50% of what goes into why they would do it.
I don't think just 50%.
Right, that is a... Right, right. Well, I think I'm being generous to say 50%. To what extent are they going there primarily to get a better sense of what is really the case in the world? To get a they want to have a true perspective on reality. That's why they go to this movie, or that's why they read this novel, because I want to have a true... That is a very small percentage, if at all. Whereas it's a much bigger percentage, I want to be entertained. Now, where do we get into the danger there, especially when we start talking about sinful man, because man is sinful? When entertainment becomes the preponderant...
Are you using the word entertainment as equivalent to the word amusement?
Well, yes. In this particular instance, that I want to be amused.
Okay. Well, even the word amuse itself, to muse is to think. To be amused is to stop thinking or to refrain from thinking.
And I think people sometimes want to have a break because there is a good role for wanting a break. There is a place for a break in life because mm-hmm. life is hard enough. However, even in when you take a break or when you take a rest, you should not stop thinking.
Right. The reason I use the broader term entertainment as opposed to just amused, because in terms of like a romantic novel, let's take, I don't know that people want to be amused so much as they want to be sometimes, some of these can be rather, they want to be titillated in some sense. I mean, in terms of they can even be almost pornographic in nature, though obviously not in visually speaking. But I'm just speaking in terms of what some of the things that go on. But they're not looking, in terms of doing it, they're not looking, how is this affecting me in terms of my spiritual walk? Because there are definitely some forms of recreation, because we, as has been mentioned, we do need breaks from our work, okay? We need times of recreation. But the question is there a due consideration of how is this particular form of recreation influencing my spiritual walk? Are there better ways so that I am edified in the faith as opposed to potentially brought down more? Again, those are just some things to consider. All right, question 16. Question 16, what image did Miss Watson paint of heaven that made it appear ridiculous and downright boring to Huck Finn? Do you remember?
They were like playing on harps in heaven.
Yes, that's right. Playing, and what was Huck Finn's sort of reaction to all this?
He thought it would be boring.
Yeah, boring. And, you know,
especially if harp is not your favorite musical instrument.
Yeah. This sort of, is this even true? Is this what the Bible, when we read what, well, first of all, did Adam and Eve, when they were in the garden, was this their life? Did they sit around all day? I'm talking about before the fall. Did they sit around all day playing harps?
No.
Okay. So it didn't happen but pre-fall. And then the question is, in terms of what we read in terms of what the new heaven and new earth is going to be like, is it necessarily going to be just sitting around playing a harp? Again, I question that. I don't think that is personally a realistic view of what Scripture says will be happening. But anyway, his purpose is certainly to make it look ridiculous. And he's meaning to be humorous here, but of course it's a mocking humor of Christianity. What hypocrisy does the narrator Huck Finn point out in the Widow Douglas' objection to smoking, and how does it serve Mark Twain's objective of ridiculing Christianity?
Didn't she herself smoke? Or was I forget?
She had a snuff box.
Yes. Yeah.
So she smoked herself.
No, it's different. A snuff box, I think, that originates, and maybe I'm not so sure about this, but I just know as a little girl we had a French song, and we had to memorize this French song, and it talked about the French loving their snuff boxes. I think it was like a little box where you had something that had a strong odor. I don't know if it was meant to make you sneeze or something.
Yeah, something like that, pleasure. Okay. Question 18. How was Huck Finn able to dismiss prayer as a useless exercise?
He said he didn't get what he wanted.
Yes, he didn't get. What did he ask for?
It's like a fishing rod.
Yeah. So he.
He said he did get the fishing rod, but it did not come with a hook.
Right.
So it was good for nothing.
Nothing. Okay. So. And then, you know, even that aspect, you know, he got half of what he wanted and it was no good. Again, one can see why. I mean, you know, even in this, we can see. I mean, I see why from a worldly standpoint this is humorous, okay? There is a, I don't think any of us could say that we don't not see
the humor in it.
Mark Twain's ability to use humor. The question is we should look beyond that, you know, looking at this as Christians and say, look, this is using humor to mock true religion. And this is not a good use of... There are ways to be humorous without mocking true religion, right? All right. Question 19. Huck Finn was not satisfied with a Widow Douglas' explanation of the purpose of prayer. How should we critique her explanation, and what would you have said if you were in such a situation? Do you remember?
The way she presented it was more like, it's just a way for God to give you what you want, basically. So it's...
Okay.
I think I said you just got to ask God what you want, and you expect God to give it to you.
I'm trying to find this exact section here. Well, I might need to come back to that because I'm not immediately finding it. So I might come back to it because I think I would like to comment on that a little more. Let's go on. Question 20. How was Mark Twain able to make humor, at least as the world defines it, by making the sublime look ridiculous? How was he able to make the sublime look ridiculous? What do we mean by the sublime? What does sublime mean?
Great.
Lofty dignified. Or great and dignified. Lofty and dignified. What? Well, first of all, do you agree that he was able to make the sublime look ridiculous? And how was he able to do that if you do believe he did?
Yes, he sort of did sometimes. Like, he sort of made fun of, not exactly the sublime, but sort of the way it was done properly.
Mm-hmm. Like even in terms of, how Huck Finn made the whole society look somewhat ridiculous in terms of being fooled by Huck Finn, in terms of some of his, his even his sort of disappearance from the city. In terms of the upper crust of society, the hypocrisy and engaging in these various feuds and so forth, making the sublime look ridiculous. Question 21. Scripture describes the scorner and the fool. Does this label fit the author of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn? Why or why not?
Yes. He mocked Christianity, and also he really didn't believe in Christianity, obviously.
Okay. Question 22. What notion did Huck Finn have about Providence, and why did he prefer the Widow Douglas's version over that of Miss Watson? Do you remember?
Nope.
Okay, well, I will read it to you. Sometimes the widow would take me one side and talk about providence in a way to make a body's mouth water. But maybe next day Miss Watson would take hold and knock it all down again. I judged I could see that there was two providences, and a poor chap would stand considerable show with a widow's providence. But if Miss Watson got him, there weren't no hope for him anymore. I thought it all out, and reckoned I would belong to the widows if he wanted me, though I couldn't make out how he was going to be any better off than what he was before, seeing I was so ignorant and so kind of low down and ornery. So, what is he saying here?
I guess he likes one providence more than the other, but it's hard to, he doesn't really explain very much why.
Mm-hmm. What was sort of, do you remember, what was sort of the difference between the Widow Douglas and Miss Watson?
I think, wasn't Miss Watson stricter?
What do you think, boys?
Did Miss Watson say it was harder to get?
I have to read it again for me to remember.
Okay. I think that they definitely were different. I want to come back to that in a little bit next week, because I want y'all to read that a little more. Those the two questions, and I'm going to look at those two. The two questions that we haven't really, I don't think, well answered. I want us to look at and come back and discuss next week. In the next class. Question 23. What ethical code did Huck conclude to follow after the incident when he pretended the man with him in the raft was his father, sick with smallpox, instead of Jim?
To do whatever was in his best advantage.
Right. So he took away the from this incident that he should do what comes handiest, as it were. And of course, that is presumably perhaps something that Mark Twain himself felt that he came away with. Well, and again, how does this feed into the cynicism?
Well, you don't act on principle, you just do whatever makes sense at the moment.
Right. More situational ethics.
There are no absolutes.
Right.
So just do what works best.
Okay, then. Well, like I say, for the two questions that I don't think we fully answered, I'd like us to finish discussing next week. But that is it for this class. Unless there are other questions that you would have. Are there any questions you would have before we move on into Chapter 7, which we are going to be looking at more poetry? No? Okay, then. Well, that closes today's class.